There we go. Okay, so.
What do you want to know about?
What I want to know, first, tell me the origin myth of See the Beat itself. I've seen you play in numerous venues, but See the Beat is your baby.
My band. The idea, the underlying idea with See the Beat is, if you look at the influence that Africa had on New World music, you can follow it. You can look at the islands. You can look at Trinidad, and you can look at Jamaica and Cuba, and all across the Caribbean, all those styles of music, from ska and reggae and calypso to Cuban rumbas and salsa and Afro-Cuban jazz, and then Central America and South America with Brazilian sambas and chichas and all these different styles of music. They're all heavily driven by percussion. And then you look at the impact on American pop music and the music of New Orleans. Professor Longhair and all that, the New Orleans style music is heavily percussion driven, and that music was influenced by calypso, American funk. But what the funny thing happened is music started to, the influence started to flow east, and you find New World pop music from various eras influencing African popular music. So early on you had Cuban rumbas, they were rumba bands in Africa that were influenced by Cuban bands. And you have reggae bands in Africa. And then you had Fela Kuti, a Nigerian musician, who with a drummer named Tony Allen sort of originated a style of music called Afrobeat. And it's influenced by James Brown and American funk, and it's sort of a mashup of Bob Dylan and James Brown. It's like James Brown with a political message.
Nice.
In fact, Fela Kuti was always in trouble with the authorities, you know, military government of Nigeria. They ended up throwing his mother out a second-story window and killing her. Threw him out the window, too, or beat him up pretty bad and put him in jail. They burned his studio down with all his recordings. And yet he still kept making records and was a real strong voice for liberation in Africa. High life music, which sort of predated Afrobeat and influenced it. There's a dialogue between the New World and Africa. The underlying part of it, though, is the rhythm. So when we started out, I'm going to take a little left swing here. The reason the band did their first gig, there's an African master percussionist named Gideon Alaworie, Alaworie.
Is Gideon, this the man that you just went to visit?
Yes.
Okay.
He's from Ghana. He's a master percussionist. He's a village chief, and he's also a priest of the Ewe, E-W-E, religion, or cult, the Ewe cult. He was very successful in Ghana, ended up moving to the States, lived in Chicago for a while where there's a large Ghanaian community, actually lived here for a while. There was some sort of grant that paid him, and he came here, and that's where Tripp met him. They're here in Chicago, one or the other. But Tripp and Gideon have known each other for many years. He now is a professor at North Texas State. Well, back in the 70s, there's a classical composer, Steve Reich, R-E-I-C-H, who's sort of a Philip Glass kind of contemporary composer, very, very well respected. He actually studied with Gideon, studied his rhythms, and incorporated those into a percussion piece.
Oh, wow.
And it's his 80th birthday in December, and he's asked Gideon to come and perform with him. So we're going to go to New York and see Gideon open for this performance of the music that Stephen Wright wrote that was inspired by Gideon's music.
Very cool.
But once a year, Gideon brings people from Ghana and then some of his students in North Texas State and other Ghanaians around the country. He'll put together a dance and percussion troupe, and he'll go play in Chicago, and then he'll come to Lexington, and then he'll go somewhere else, and then he'll go back to Texas and send everybody home. And he's been doing this for a number of years. So about 3 or 4 years ago, he was coming to town, and we set him up a gig at Natasha's, the old Natasha's.
I think I remember that, yeah.
And I had talked to Tripp about putting this band together, about doing something like this. So we quickly worked up 4 songs by Fela Kuti and Tony Allen and opened for them. And that was our first gig. Okay. So at that time I had 5 horns in the band. We had 3 percussionists. So it's always been a pretty good sized band. But that was enough to kind of get the ball rolling. And then at that point I started looking for other material, and finally got enough material together that we could start playing out. We started playing. And Natasha's was our home club.
Yeah.
At that point,
we played there about once a month.
Well, it was. There's no listening room in town right now.
Right. Tom Martin just said the same thing.
Natasha's was a listening room where people would get a reserve seat, go in and sit at a table, and the focus was the music.
Right.
You know. I like the Borough. The Borough's a great club. I'm really happy that Willie's is still alive and that they have that nice big room.
Yeah.
But these places don't have the intimacy that's required for a listening room, for jazz and acoustic music, you know, to really be able to hear the nuances. So I miss Natasha's. Hopefully someday somebody will come along and fill in that gap.
There's definitely a gap. Oh, yeah.
So go ahead.
The name of the band.
It's my wife. Made it up.
Okay, okay.
C being my last name.
I assume.
Yeah.
Cool.
C the Beat. You know, I have a number of groups,
mm-hmm.
and what I've tried to do is kind of create a brand so that if I'm attached to it, that hopefully people will think, well, this is going to be legit and worth maybe coming to. So I'll use my name in the title of a band, and it's not ego driven. It's like, how do you market yourself now?
Right.
So Facebook is my primary way of reaching folks.
Right.
And so I've created a page for each of my bands. And Lee Carroll's Soul Jazz, which can be anywhere from a trio to 5 pieces. See you, Eddie. Then I play with the Northside Sheiks, which is a band that I got into with Willie Ames. Mm-hmm. And we play most every Tuesday at Henry Clay's Public House.
Yeah. And then
See the Beat. And then I play with some other bands through the years.
Yeah.
And
you're still with the Townies too, right?
No.
Okay.
I just reached a point where I didn't have time. You know, I'll do some one-off stuff. I've played with DeBron Thomas, and mm-hmm. I'll probably play with him some more moving forward. I've thought about putting together some other bands because I like playing different styles of music.
Yes.
You know, and that's what one thing C the Beat allows. We can cover a lot of ground.
Yeah. That leads me briefly to my next question. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I've seen you play in all except your soul jazz. I have yet to catch that one. And different styles of music. Mm-hmm. Do you prepare differently to play different styles of music?
No, I just show up.
Okay. Nice. I like that. Excellent.
Well, I've been playing since I was 15, and I'm 63.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I... 48 years?
Yeah, you're not a novice.
No, I did take a 10-year period off. When I left Nashville to get into my current job, which is I'm a Papa John's franchisee.
Right.
I left Nashville. I moved to somewhere I didn't know anybody. Mm-hmm. I had a 2-year-old son who had, you know, had medical
problems. Who had
problems
been ill.
But he was doing okay. He was 2 years old. And I had to start a company and figure out how to, you know, build this business. And it was just all-consuming. So I didn't know any musicians, and at that point with a 2-year-old, you don't get out of the house hanging in the clubs, you know, you don't get out to meet people. And I put all my attention on starting and building my business and taking care of my family. And truth is, I left Nashville so twisted up that I really didn't miss playing.
Yeah.
You know, I miss my friends.
There's a song line for you.
Oh, God. Yeah, I've seen Nashville chew people up and spit them out. And it's like it's a machine to generate income.
Mm-hmm.
It has very little to do with music most of the time.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, what that last guy had this hit, let's make that same record.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a lot of... There are a lot of forces that hinder you from being creative.
Yeah.
Now, I will say I do really appreciate those who are successful in Nashville who are doing what they love.
Right.
But I'm not a country music fan.
Yeah.
And I was never going to be happy doing that. So when Exile was breaking up and I had to decide what to do, I can try to get in the studios, but that was a small group of people making all the records, and that takes years if you're good enough. And I don't really like the music, so you know, I'm not going to spend my whole life doing that. I can get on the road with somebody as a sideman, but I'm going to be gone all the time, and my son's going to grow up, and I'm not going to be there for him. And after what we've been through with his illness, I wasn't going to miss him growing up.
Absolutely.
Every day was a gift, so it was an easy decision. When my brother called me up and said, "I want to go into business." Talking about it, he says, "Well, all my friends are in this Papa John's thing and doing really well. I want to do it, but I can't. He's a doctor."
Yeah.
He says, "I need a partner who can run this thing.
Do the groundwork,
And I looked into it. I realized it was an opportunity of a lifetime for me to be home with my son, wife, and perhaps, if I was lucky, to be able to make retirement money, so I didn't have to worry about what am I going to do when I'm 80 years old.
Right.
And on the music side, that just didn't seem a possibility anymore. At one time it did. You know, when I was with Exile and we were all writing songs and we had a record deal, and you know, you're able to buy a house and put your wife through college and have a car and buy all the gear you want. And, you know, the quality of life is definitely better than the average musician.
Yeah.
But you're not making retirement money on that level.
Yeah.
You know, you're making a middle-class living. I equate it to perhaps being in a minor league sport.
Yeah.
You know, you have Reba McEntire and Garth Brooks and the Judds and whoever at the top, and they're filling arenas, and those people have made it. Then you have a whole lot of acts that are out there just kind of working.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're making some pretty good money, but... The band isn't saving any, you know. It's how much it takes to live,
right?
You know, and it's a good quality of life, and I couldn't complain about how that went. But when it was time to get out of it, it wasn't all that hard.
You know, you still practiced at home, I assume. Played with your kid.
No, I quit for 10 years.
Really, you didn't touch a piano for 10 years?
Maybe once a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's interesting.
Starting a company was the most creative thing I ever did. It was much more creative than writing songs and making an album. Because every day for 2 years I had to learn to do something, figure out something that I'd never done before. So starting a business from scratch. So it was very stimulating. And I really didn't miss playing music as much as I did my artists and musician friends and people who I've been with, you know, had relationships with for decades.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I moved to a very conservative part of Pennsylvania. And I looked up and down my street when I moved there, and lawyer, 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 accountant, lawyer, lawyer, lawyer. And I'd come from Nashville where it was, you know, guitar player, pedal steel player, artist, that I, you know.
Yeah.
So it was a hard adjustment.
Big culture shock.
Yeah, it was a culture shock. But I don't regret it. And not playing for 10 years is probably the best thing I ever did for not playing.
Really?
Yeah, because when I came back to it, it was like I was 16 again, but I could play.
I like that.
You know, it wasn't tainted by expectations to succeed or make a living at it. It was just for the joy of playing. And that's how I approach everything I do now. See the Beat. At this point, we're not doing any original material. It's all taking other people's material and reimagining it, or maybe, you know, faithfully reproducing some of it. We seldom rehearse. Mm-hmm. You know, we hadn't played since the last gig.
Okay.
A month ago.
Okay.
We'll generally try to rehearse once before each gig, but we couldn't do it this time.
Mm-hmm.
So a band that size, one, nobody's going to make any money.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a time commitment.
Right.
And I've tried to design the thing so that it's as little time commitment as it can be for anybody.
Right.
And yet it'd be a fun experience. So we make a mistake on stage, I'm not going to yell at anybody about it.
Right.
It's just like, hey, keep playing. You know, if you're not having fun on this stage, you're in the wrong group. You know, because nobody's going to judge you. And that allows, it's very liberating.
Mm-hmm.
So you saw like Chase last night, the trombone player. He now has a
I actually got a photo of him playing that was.
Ocarina. It's an ocarina.
Oh, it's an ocarina. Okay.
Yeah. He plays the hell out of the ocarina.
Yeah.
And he pulls that whenever he wants to and plays it. I'm not going to yell at him for pulling it out. You know, it's not like, oh, you're not following the book.
Yeah.
I want them to be creative.
Yeah.
You know? And the horn section over there making up parts in the middle of songs and playing them together. And
yeah.
That's perfectly fine. You know?
It's fun. It's fun. As being in the crowd, seeing you guys dialogue through the music, mm-hmm. hearing you dialogue through the music, I think is the best part. That's what gets everyone up and moving.
So that's what that is. You know, it's never going to be perfectly tight or, you know, overly rehearsed. It's just going to be kind of spontaneous. And, you know, I just try to build a framework that's comfortable for everybody, and then we play.
Yeah. Very cool. Okay, so tell me about the crowd. Of all your venues, this is definitely the most dancingest crowd that first see the beat.
We would push the tables back at Natasha's.
Yes. Well, no, I'm saying not just Willie's. I'm saying see the beat.
Well, that was the point of see the beat.
Yes. So tell me about that.
From the beginning.
How do you feed off the crowd?
Well, from the beginning, see the beat was intended to be a dance band.
Okay.
Right? But it was never going to be a dance band that would play, you know, popular dance music or 80s hits and stuff.
Right.
Plenty of those. the point was to play music that we really liked. They had a nice, you know, good beat, and it would get people up out of their seats, and they would enjoy themselves in spite of the fact we were playing good music. You know, and we succeeded to a great extent.
Absolutely.
You know, we turn every... Oh. We turn every show into a party, you know. And if people don't get up, I feel kind of bad, you know. So sometimes it takes 3 or 4 songs to get people up out of their seats. So. But once they do, generally they're up all night. And you do feed off of that, you know. It definitely, it's easier to play. It's easier to find the energy in yourself to play when you're getting feedback from the folks in the crowd that they like what you're doing. If they're dancing, they like what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy to see. You know? And that just inspires you more.
Absolutely. Cool. If I can compare Willie's to Natasha's a little bit, I've seen you play at both, and I've seen you play at Moondance, which is a totally different kind of family-friendly more thing. Natasha's, it seemed like it was more a certain demographic, whereas Willie's last night, I noticed you had 18-year-olds all the way up to 70-year-olds, and everyone was dancing.
Yeah.
Do the venues feed into it differently, or do you...
it's going to... I think Willie's has a very... they seem to be doing very well as a restaurant. So there's a crowd there that's not specifically a music crowd.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to Willie's and get some barbecue. Mm-hmm. Now, old Willie's, where it was tiny, it wasn't so much. I mean, it was a listening room also.
Mm-hmm.
So within, 6 months, both listening rooms in town closed up. Willie's was, the old Willie's had one of the best sounding rooms I've ever played in.
Mm-hmm.
The stage was wonderful for the musicians because you could hear every nuance of everything everybody played on stage. The new Willie's is a very large room with a very high ceiling. And they have a good sound system and a good sound man, Matthew Florence, on sound. But it will never have that intimacy the old Willie's had or that Natasha's had. And when we played at Natasha's and people were dancing, they were right there. You know, they might as well have been on stage with you. And that also created an intimacy and an excitement. Whereas the new Willie's, it's a much larger room and a much higher ceiling, and and the stage is higher, and it's more like you're on stage, you know, and the audience is down there. It's not bad. You know, you can see the band really well from wherever you're sitting. You can fit two or three times as many people in there as you could in the Tosh's, certainly the old Willie's. So there's some benefits to it. Plus, you can get a really good barbecue sandwich and ribs.
Man, those ribs.
Yeah, those ribs are killer. So I'm very grateful that Willie's is still around, and they've done a great job. They found a really good room. I think people like that there's a venue on Southland Drive. So it's drawing a different demographic. One of the difficulties in Lexington is the sort of geographic segmentation that exists.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
People don't want to drive across town, have a few drinks and drive home, which to an extent is understandable. But you get outside New Circle Road and there's not that many people that actually come in to downtown to support live music.
Right.
So, you know, last night we had 75 paying customers. It's a 10-piece band.
Yeah.
The room would easily have handled another 75 people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it would have felt great. It would have been just packed. It was Friday night, Halloween week. And yeah, there were more people there than 75 people. Those were just the paying customers, because some people were there just to eat.
Right.
And were already there. And I don't know, you know, how that all works out. Mm-hmm. But we live in a time where it's very difficult to get people to come out and support live music.